Welcome to Charles Dickens, A Brain on Fire, a series that digs deep into the life and works of one of the greatest novelists of all time. Hello everyone, welcome to this first episode. Today I'm talking to the critically acclaimed author and broadcaster Lucinda Hawksley, who is none other than Charles Dickens's great-great-great-granddaughter. Lucinda's book, Dickens and Christmas, has now been published in paperback and is a journey through all the Christmases in Dickens's life and the story of how he wrote his five Christmas novellas, from A Christmas Carol through to The Haunted Man and The Ghost's Bargain. Right, so it's a cold, wet day in December right now, so let's sit by the fire and watch the light as it flickers on those quaint Dutch tiles. Outside, a church clock strikes its quarter, while two sisters strike across the field, and I think I can hear the faint sound of a cricket chirping somewhere on the hearth. Lucinda is here now, so let's invite her in, and turn our backs against that mysterious shadow gathering in the corner.
Hello, Lucinda, welcome.
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me.
Not at all, it's a pleasure, and I'd like you to know straight off that you are the very first guest on this podcast.
That's very exciting, I like that.
And quite right, too. So I'm absolutely thrilled. I have a few questions for you. I think the first one, which really interested me to ask you, actually, is what your first memories of Dickens are yourself.
I remember when I was at primary school, and I was probably about 6 or 7. And The teacher said to my class, "Has anybody heard of Charles Dickens?" And I thought that my parents were playing some weird joke on me. So I said, quite nervously, because I remember thinking I was going to be the butt of some joke I didn't understand. He's my great-great-great-grandfather. And she just went, and the look on her face and the kind of sound that she made. And I remember thinking, other people know who he is. Yeah. And it was quite extraordinary to me, because until that time, I think I must have been told about Oliver, because I'd been taken to see the musical of Oliver.
Yeah.
So, and I must have known about A Christmas Carol. I can't really remember, but I remember thinking, oh, he must be famous. So I'd always known about him, talked about in my family, but I didn't know that people outside my family really talked about him.
Yes. I suppose as we're in the sort of Christmas season, then was A Christmas Carol your first introduction? You mentioned Oliver, so maybe Oliver was your first kind of introduction to his work, perhaps?
Probably both together. I know we had a book about A Christmas Carol, and I remember my dad had some other editions that he'd been sent. There was one in particular that had photographs, in fact, of puppets. I was a little bit scared of it, because these photographs were a kind of slightly spooky puppets, and as a child I wasn't particularly keen on them. So I remember that very vividly, and I remember my dad exclaiming over it, saying how true it was to the original. I remember that vividly, but I don't know how old I was. My grandmother used to take me to see Oliver every single school holidays. We'd go and stay with her in London. But actually, it was nothing to do with being related to Dickens. It was because her lodger worked at the theatre. It was the Adelphi Theatre. And then after a while, it became My Fair Lady, because that replaced Oliver. So I could, both of those plays, I think I know every single word, because he used to take us every time we were in London. But wow. I do remember one time going to the theatre with my grandmother. And I think Bill, her lodger, had told people that there were some descendants of Dickens in the audience. And we were very, very little, and being given the star treatment, and they signed a programme for us, and being quite amazed by that. So it would be perhaps Oliver and Christmas Carol at a very similar time when I was little. I've always remembered Christmas Carol, and I don't know when the first time I knew about it was. It's always been a part of my life, as in fact I think it is with everybody, whether you're related to Dickens or not. I think A Christmas Carol is something we grow up with as babies onwards. You know, people talk about it, they talk about Scrooge. I always knew who Scrooge was, for example. I think I always knew who Tiny Tim was. I don't remember ever having it explained to me. I think they're just in the psyche.
Yes, it is everywhere, and he is everywhere, particularly through A Christmas Carol, isn't he? And I sort of wondered, how does it feel for you being his great-great-great-granddaughter? Do you feel that there's any part of him that belongs just to you and your family, or does he belong to everyone?
He absolutely belongs to everyone. And in fact, that's lovely. I mean, it really is amazing. I've been to so many places in the world where I've been staggered to see references to Dickens. You know, you walk down a street and you see a bar called Pickwick. I find he's there all the time. And the thing I think for me personally is, because of my research into his family life, which came about for me through art, So my first book that related to Dickens was a biography of his daughter, Katie, Kate Perugini, the portrait painter. And it was my second biography. The first one was on a Pre-Raphaelite artist, Lizzie Siddle. So nothing to do with Dickens. And through studying Katie and researching her to write this book, and the first version of this book took 5 years to research, and then, which was wonderful, people got in touch with me and gave me more information about paintings they had. So I was able to update it, which took about another 18 months. So I spent very many years absorbed in Dickens' family life. And that just happens to be the life of my ancestors. Other books have taken just as long, but aren't part of my family. I've really got to know his relationship with his children, the way that he was as a father, on a very, very detailed level. And that was something I had never come across before. So for me, that feels very personal. Katie, I feel particularly connected to. She's my great, great, great aunt. I'm descended from her younger brother, Henry. Because I was just looking at her life so intimately, I feel a really strong connection to her. And she was incredibly close to her father. So there's that lovely connection through that. I don't think we can just claim him otherwise, because he is so known and so loved and so studied and so recognized all over the world. And people always say, oh, what do you have in the family that's secret that no one's ever known about? Well, that's just definitely not going to happen. You know, and journalists always ask me that every year, every Christmas particularly. And it always makes me laugh, because I think, do you really think if there was this secret that has remained unknown, you know, 160 years or whatever, that I would reveal it to you for free in an article? No, I'd be writing a book.
Yes, so you're not going to reveal it to me either.
Sorry,
there isn't one. No, that, well, I'm sort of pleased, actually. I think that's great. I mean, the mystery around him is also as fascinating as what we do know, isn't it? And I think that comes into his work as well. So something like, if we're thinking his Christmas books and we go chronologically, I mean, first of all, the year 1843, I mean, that was an extraordinary year for just Christmas, wasn't it? A sense of Christmas.
It is an incredible year. The whole, what Dickens did was capture the zeitgeist, because it's the whole zeitgeist that really happens in that year to bring Christmas to the forefront of people's minds. And Christmas Carol was an enormous part of that, but it wasn't the only element in that. And when Dickens first started writing A Christmas Carol, and he wrote it all in just 6 weeks, you know, this wasn't as if he had a big build-up. His publishers, even then, thought that it was a ridiculous idea. It was not going to be commercially successful. They didn't think Christmas was a commercial subject, which always makes me laugh. But there were many people like him who felt that Christmas needed a renaissance, that it had lost its charitable status. That was the biggest thing. It had changed, and that it needed to go back to what it had been before, which was about helping other people, about a community spirit, about giving poorer people food, clothing, taking care of them. This was the crux of it. And Dickens, of course, when he wrote A Christmas Carol, the crux of it was poor children. That was his campaign. Ignorance and want, who appear with The Ghost of Christmas Present, are the key for Dickens into this story, that not just Ebenezer Scrooge, but every reader of A Christmas Carol needs to be aware of how they are neglecting the poorest and most desperate in society. And of course, Dickens never forgot, although most of his readers didn't know, that he had been a poor child himself. He had never been in the situations of ignorance and want. He did have extended family members who could help him while his parents were in the debtor's prison. But he was very aware of how easy it was to fall into that poverty net. He really wanted people to change that. But then at the same time, you've got Prince Albert, who's recently married Queen Victoria, who brings the German Christmas traditions out of the hidden aspects of the royal family and starts to make them more known to the public. It's a few years before the Christmas tree will be shown in public. But all of that idea of Christmas traditions and all the lovely things the royal family had been keeping to themselves start to get disseminated more widely. And yes, then Henry Cole, who had commissioned the very first Christmas card in 1843, the same year that Christmas Carol was published, pure coincidence. So he commissioned an artist friend, and he had a print run that was more than he needed. So he sold the others commercially, and they weren't successful that first year. Not all of them sold, but it began the tradition of printing, selling, sending Christmas cards. And this all happened in 1843, which of course collided with the start of the Hungry 40s, the time of the famine in Ireland, the time that people were just feeling really desperate in many parts of the United Kingdom and overseas. And it really started to be the idea that Christmas needs to be about helping those who need it. It shouldn't just be about wearing finery, feasting on great food, looking in the newspaper to see what Lady So-and-so did, what the Duchess did at her ball. those are the things that have become far too common in newspapers. And people were saying, no, we want to have the spirit of Christmas back. And of course, Christmas Carol captured that need, that desire in people. Dickens knew far more than his publishers what the public wanted. And he just distilled that into this one glorious story, which has stood the test of time for so long and is still today speaking to people.
Yes. You mentioned Henry Cole as well in his Christmas card. And if I remember rightly, on the card, there's a family around a table, isn't there, enjoying Christmas. And there's also, but there's also in this, on the same card, there are images of the poor. Is that right? Or is that another Christmas?
That's right. So on either side, there are images of the poor being given food and clothing.
Which is so astonishing. You don't expect that on a Christmas card today, do you? You don't. That's not what you want through your letterbox. You don't tend to see that. It's always nice snowy landscapes, red letterboxes and foxes running around and stuff.
And a lot of the snow, by the way, comes from Dickens. You know, he wrote about snow at Christmas so frequently. And although it wasn't that common in Victorian times in Britain, just as it isn't common on Christmas Day today in most parts of Britain. However, when I went through the Met Office archives, it turns out that in the first 8 years of Dickens's life, there were 6 white Christmases. And it was just this, what was called this little mini ice age. So in fact, the very final Frost Fair was held in Britain. They'd been held obviously many years earlier, and then the climate had got a bit warmer. And then in the Christmas of 1813 to 14, that winter in which Charles Dickens turned 2 in February of 1814, all through that Christmas, New Year, right up through Dickens's birthday, the Thames had frozen over again and there was a Frost Fair. Now, Dickens was actually living in Kent. The family were in Kent at that time in his life, but not that far from London. And of course, people were travelling from all around London to come in and see the Frost Fair, this incredible spectacle. So when Dickens looked back to his childhood, even as an adult, not seeing very many white Christmases in his adulthood, what he would remember is Christmas is snowy. And that's where all those snowy images of Christmas, which are called Dickensian images, come from.
Yes, and actually the term Dickensian is interesting, isn't it? Because it's used to talk about things that are celebratory and fun and joyful, and also things that are incredibly bleak and hard and dark as well at the same time. I was just thinking, it's funny you mentioned the weather about in the 1840s, and like today, we have reasonably mild winters by comparison to the mini ice age back then. I did read some newspaper articles at the time talking about how it was like April in 1843, that people were leaving their windows open because it was actually quite warm, which is sort of kind of extraordinary. But my question for you about the Frost Fair is, would you have had the courage, if you could go back in time, to strike out and walk about the Thames frozen?
Or would you walk edges of the Thames, but when you read about people walking into the middle and they've got spits roasting meat, and you think, I'm in the middle of a frozen river and somebody burning a fire and everyone's sitting around it for warmth. I'm not good with cold anyway, Dominic. You know, I'm somebody who will go off for sunshine. I'm not going to be going skiing in the snow. I'd have gone and watched it. But I tell you the other thing I wouldn't have done, which is what made me laugh in the newspaper articles, how many people went and gambled everything and then didn't have their penny to get back across the kind of bridge that had been created that you could walk across. Oh my goodness, the thought of being stranded in the middle of the frozen Thames.
So that's what happened. That's you. What, you're left in the middle of the Thames waiting for it to thaw. You're not allowed back onto dry land. That's amazing.
What made me laugh was that none of the articles explained how any of these people did get back. Presumably they must have done. They just talk about them having gambled everything away and not having anything to get their penny to pay their passage back across the bridge.
Wow. They probably had to do a stint in debtor's prison or something, or pushed into a workhouse or something. Gosh, that's...
Probably had to hand over their watch or something to be allowed across.
Gosh. What's interesting, you're mentioning about not liking cold weather very much. Well, it seems like your great ancestor also then in 1844 gets the hell out of London as quickly as he can, goes off to Italy for half the year. Yeah. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And what makes me laugh is that then he's writing letters to John Forster saying how terrible the weather is and how cross he is. So in October, the middle of October, when he was working on The Chimes, his second Christmas book, and he wrote to John Forster in October and said, it's worse than any November weather. You've never seen rain like it, not in Scotland, not in America. It's far worse than a London November.
It's so odd, isn't it? Because I'm always, when I'm picking up a Christmas book of Dickens, you're always waiting for the snow and you feel like he loves it and he wants to go and lie down in it and make an angel shape in the snow or something, that he loves that weather so much. But you find out that not only quite a few of the Christmas books don't tend to mention the snow very much. Also, I find that that interesting. And you were saying also, just to wind back about the Christmas Carol, that sense of wanting to tell people the truth about poverty and how people get there and what needs to be done. And I think this is right, and I'm taking this really from your book, is that Dickens had then a sense that too many people could read A Christmas Carol, be very moved by it, and then think that it didn't apply to them. And so yes. When he comes to write the chimes, the gloves are off. I sort of said recently that if A Christmas Carol was The Wizard of Oz, the chimes is Return to Oz. There's something harder and bleaker and harsher.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, the chimes is quite an extraordinary book to me, because I just find it, the idea of the kind of misanthropy of Trotty Veck, who is the main character, you know, he's been led by the media to believe that poor people like he should not be encouraged to marry or have children, that really they're just too mean and useless to be expected to be on the face of the earth. And he's totally led by the media. And Dickens is criticizing him for falling for it, but also criticizing the media. Well, that's not something we really think about as being current in 1844. But the sadness with which Dickens views the way that poorer people are portrayed in the press at that time, and the fact that Trotty is then not wanting his daughter to marry the man that she loves, because they shouldn't, because they're poor. So why are they getting married? What's the point? And of course, the redemption, just as comes for Scrooge, comes for Trotty when he realizes that it doesn't matter that they're poor. They're good people. They have every right, if not more right than anyone else, to be happy.
Yes. And I think it's sort of more subtle, because if you think of A Christmas Carol, it's very obvious why Scrooge is visited by four ghosts, isn't it? But with Trotty, the night that he goes up into that bell tower and meets the goblins, that very night, he has saved a man and a young girl and taken them home, not had any dinner himself, spent all the money he has to give them food and take nothing for himself. And yet he still has to learn a hard lesson, because he picks up a newspaper and, like you said, he unquestionably swallows everything that's said, which makes him believe that this woman who tries to kill herself, well, does kill herself and her young child by jumping in the Thames. And it's based on Mary Thurley. I think I remember that name right. There was a real news story running around at the time. But I think that's extraordinary, isn't it? So it is harsher for that, just that fact, I think.
It is. And it's just very sad that Dickens knew that that was really how people were being made to feel.
Yeah.
And really addressing the cruelty of the media at that time. And he would respond very strongly to real news stories, as we know in all of his works. He wrote his own journalism as well. He was an excellent journalist. But all of his fiction, he brings in these real life stories, some of them amusing, some of them heartbreaking. And we can tell how disturbed he is by the terrible things that happen to people. And Dickens wants other people to see them, to think, did you miss this? Did you miss this story? Did you not care? Did you think, oh, she's just a poor woman who's had a child? You know, why does she deserve to live? She's no better than she should be, which was the kind of prevailing attitude of the time. You know, it was illegal to be a pauper. You could be imprisoned for being poor. It's absolutely insane to think how that happened. And yet all around the world, there are still those restrictions on people. I mean, Britain has become a much more divided society in recent years, and people are getting poorer, and the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Once again, we are heading back towards that inequality that Charles Dickens saw. And I think The Chimes, which very few people know, is actually such a resonant tale for today, because we're blinded not just by media, but by social media. We're made to believe that we're not good enough. You know, we don't look right. We don't sound right. We don't have the right qualifications. We can't do this. We're restricted. We're not on a yacht. Therefore, there's something wrong with our lives. It's the same thing. People are constantly made to believe that they are not good enough.
Yes, absolutely. Definitely a story for our time. That thing, as you're saying, about Trotty reading uncritically and taking in and absorbing everything.
If a journalist has written it, it's got to be right. You know, the same kind of thing today. If it's on Facebook, my friend wrote it, therefore it's right. They copied it from some random stranger, but it's definitely the gospel truth. And that's exactly what Trotty is doing. And it's the gullibility of the reader, but also the responsibility, which Dickens as a journalist knew, the responsibility of the journalist to get it right. Now, very early in his career, he was picked up on by MPs. There was a particular MP whose name escapes me, who requested that Charles Dickens attend all of his speeches, because he was the only journalist who actually repeated what was said faithfully in the speech, whereas the others just kind of, you know, gave a gist of it, usually got it wrong. Dickens always had that integrity, and that's what I guess he feels is lacking in a lot of those newspaper reports that Trotty Veck is reading.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting also, one of the reasons I like the chimes a lot, one is it feels new because it is rare, like many of the Christmas books, actually, because there aren't hundreds of adaptations every year. There aren't Christmas adverts that sort of parody, you know, a Christmas Carol. Yeah. But I think what's sort of fascinating about it is that Dickens is kind of visiting that spirit world a bit in the way he did with the Pickwick Papers story, the goblin who stole a sexton, the Gabriel Grubb. Yeah. So you've got these goblins coming back again and you have spirits. And I have to say, I think if we're going to put Gabriel Grubb next to Ebenezer Scrooge and Trotty, I think Gabriel Grubb's the bigger bastard, actually, of the three of them.
I totally agree. And that is the Christmas story that's related in the Pickwick Papers that is, you know, one of the earliest Christmas writings that Dickens did. And people don't know that one very often. Fans of Pickwick, obviously, always talk about it every Christmas. But no, these other things, I mean, this year, we have, you know, the Aldi advert, I think it is, that has Ebenezer Scrooge and Marcus Rutherford, which to me is just absolute genius. And also, I was really moved when I saw that advert. I know it's for, you know, supermarket, but I love the fact that Marcus Rutherford is doing exactly what Dickens was doing. Yeah. And I love the fact that he's kind of put into that Christmas Carol context, because his work is as important as Dickens's, trying to make sure that poor children get enough to eat. Food poverty, which is shocking in Britain in the 21st century. It's appalling that we have people who have to choose between feeding themselves and feeding their children.
You mentioned Marcus Rutherford. I suppose he is very much the Dickensian of the moment, isn't he? You know, he's, because of that. And I think what's so lovely is that you really feel that you can know Dickens, don't you? Because not only because of the way he writes, and he writes in that fantastic, embracing way where he's like that sort of mad uncle in the room with you, sort of really talking to you one-to-one by the fire, but it's just also what he did in his life. He actually got out there and really made changes in people's lives.
Yes, and I think people don't realise that Christmas Carol grew out of a government report that Dickens had been going to write about child poverty based on the facts of the time, that a friend of his had done all the research into kind of child labour, child poverty. And he just thought, well, who's going to read this? A couple of MPs? You know, why would I be doing this? And what he did then was to turn it into fiction and to place at the heart of it ignorance and want. And sadly, so many adaptations, particularly earlier adaptations, leave out ignorance and want. I've been cheered to see that in recent years they've been kept in because they are the crux of the story. But I think, you know, that in the kind of 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a thing, oh, they're a bit too depressing, they're a bit too boring, let's leave them out. Well, you've lost the essence of A Christmas Carol. If you don't have those two desperate children in there, Christmas Carol loses its meaning.
And you also essentially slander Dickens as well, because that charge laid against him about him being overly sentimental. And you think, well, yes, you only think that he's sentimental if you're reading him out of context or watching him adapted out of context, and you're missing half the piece. That's absolutely right, I think. Although on the subject of sentimentality, there is a slight lean towards that, perhaps for our tastes in the 21st century, in some of the other Christmas books that come along, possibly.
Particularly The Battle of Life, which I do have, you know, I find it quite hard to get enthusiastic about. But then, you know, at the time, all of his Christmas books, all five of them, were incredibly popular. And each one was more popular than the one the year before. So for us, the one that everybody knows is A Christmas Carol, and I think deservedly so, because to me, that is, I think, about the most superb thing Dickens wrote. It's written from the heart. He wrote it just in 6 weeks. And it is his protest. It is his cry from the heart about change the world. You know, he was calling on society to change. Not just Ebenezer Scrooge, but every single reader needed to change. Whereas the later ones, they were all done with that sense of commercial need. Suddenly the Christmas story is a big thing. It's not only Dickens, every publisher is trying to get out there. They're asking every writer, do a Christmas story. So although Dickens's later ones were written with passion, none of them was written with that absolute fervour. And I think that's why Christmas Carol stands the test of time so well. My other favourite, which very few people know, but I know you do, Dominic, because obviously you, like I, have a great interest in Dickens's supernatural writings, is The Haunted Man, which was his last Christmas book. And like A Christmas Carol, it grew out of a real passion, and that was grief. Dickens was grieving. When he wrote this book, he had lost his much-loved older sister, Frances, known in the family as Fanny. She was the rock in his life, the only sibling who was older than he was. And he paid lots of doctors to try and save her, but She died of tuberculosis, what was then called consumption, at the age of 38. And Dickens's final Christmas book, he went on to write, of course, short stories, but his final Christmas novella of the five was The Haunted Man in 1848, the year of her death. And his main character is a chemistry professor who is mourning the death of his sister. And so for me, that is such an intimate, personal book. The essence of it is wonderful. And I think it's as brilliant in that respect as A Christmas Carol.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I love that story as well. I remember seeing Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind about 20 years ago when it was at the cinema. I've not seen it since, but I get the feeling that The Haunted Man, perhaps in some ways, is a little bit of a blueprint for that later idea there. But just...
I'm going to have to watch that again. I haven't seen that for years.
Neither have I. And I can't really remember what happens, but I wonder if there might be some sort of link there, this idea of trying to erase your bad memories. But it's such a deeply profound idea, isn't it? The idea that if you lose your bad memories, your suffering, you have no more sense of it, you lose your empathy and your compassion for other people's suffering.
It's such a modern idea. I mean, it presages, which with extraordinary, and for me, extraordinary accuracy, and I find it quite slightly frightening, really, that Dickens almost knew what was going to happen in the kind of Prozac world, where everybody who gives any kind of sign of depression, you know, in Dickens's time, depression was seen as madness and you'd be put into an asylum. Now people are chemically treated, and that can be great when it works. But when it's just given out as just, you know, oh, this teenager's feeling a bit depressed, we're going to put them on medication, and they lose everything. They become that kind of zombie-like, which you know, you see happen in so many young people. And I see it particularly prevalent in the US, where so many of my friends say, you know, teenagers here are just all medicated. It's horrifying. And they're never allowed a normal emotion. And I feel this is really what happens in The Haunted Man, is that you're deadened to any other as well, any other feelings. So yes, it might take away the great lows, but it also takes away the joy, the happiness, the great highs. And if somebody is given medication that isn't right for them, it can do the same thing. And this is almost as if Dickens was seeing into the future, just as Aldous Huxley did with Brave New World, and envisaging things like a contraceptive pill, like Tinder, like all these different, you know, babies grown in test tubes, fetal alcohol syndrome, all these things that Huxley saw from his scientific background. I feel like Dickens did that with The Haunted Man, looking into the future and seeing a world where people's pain was dealt with by removing all emotion, good or bad. You know, this hinterland where people wander through, unable to feel empathy, unable to understand because their senses have been deliberately blunted.
Yes, that's very well put. And I think with The Haunted Man as well, what I find interesting about that central character, once he makes the bargain with the Phantom to have all of his memories taken away, and then he has this kind of Midas situation where people he comes into contact with also lose their bad memories, apart from a few that you mentioned in the book again. There's something interesting in that when he pleads with the ghost to have it reversed, this curse that he's been given, he doesn't plead for himself, which I find interesting, because I think he wants other people who he's affected to recover, but he doesn't seem to mind what happens to himself. It's that sort of selflessness, which is an interesting idea, because I remember a few years ago someone saying, oh yeah, well, Scrooge only changes because he's worried what's going to happen to him. And you think, no, that's not true. But I can understand if you cynically read A Christmas Carol, you might think that Scrooge is only kind of, he's seen lots of bad stuff and goes, okay, I'll be good. I don't know. What do you think?
Of course, then we know that, you know, he's so worried about Tiny Tim. Yeah. And that, I think, is thing with Scrooge. I mean, he worries it, that general thing, but it's not just him. He doesn't want to go back and see the crutch in the corner without Tiny Tim being able to be there in the family as well. And I think that's the moment that you see that switch, is he cares about a child. You know, that's the important thing in Dickens, children and animals. If somebody is cruel to a child or an animal, you know, in all of Dickens's writing, this person is terrible. You know, the man in Oliver Twist who beats his donkey, we know he's a villain. You know, Bill Sykes beats his dog, you know, we know he's going to move on to humans. And I think with Scrooge, there's an element of that, but he also really does have a proper redemption. In The Haunted Man, the thing I find so fascinating about Redlaw is, you're quite right that he doesn't think about himself. And to me, that says a great deal about Dickens' own depression, that he understood. Dickens truly understood depression, because he suffered from depression. Of course, it was probably not even called that in the 19th century. Depression was not understood or treated properly by the medical profession. As I say, in women particularly, it was usually seen as madness. that both Charles and his wife Catherine suffered from depression. And early in their marriage, although people tend to judge the marriage just by the end of it, Dickens was actually a very good husband. He tried to help Catherine through what we would recognise as postnatal depression. He would take her away to try kind of water cures at spas, really try to help her get back to a good mental state because he'd been there. Dickens has suffered, I think, when you look back throughout his life, from childhood onwards, he struggled with depression, which people today can understand. And Redlaw, when he's wanting to save those around him, but not himself, I feel he's still so sunk in that depression that Dickens understood that he has almost been subsumed into it and he can't see a way out. And that, to me, is really key to understanding a lot of Dickens' own personality and sadness.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this comes back to that thing again, the charge of sentimentality laid against Dickens. And you think, well, the things that happened in his life, in the life of prosperous people who lost so many children through just infant mortality, which was through the roof all the time, the lives were hard. So yes, if they do sort of wax lyrical in a way that's a bit musical and to our ears and a little bit sentimental, they've earned it, I think is the point. 100%.
Also the public wanted it. Dickens was hugely commercial. They wanted women who, you know, were very kind of domesticated, the kind of women that everybody thought was the ideal woman, the Queen Victoria style. Every woman should be within the home and totally in love with her family. But the real women in Dickens' life were very different from these women in his books. So, you know, his sisters, his mother, his great friends, people like Angela Burdett Coutts, Elizabeth Gaskell, all these women who he worked with, these incredibly strong women, often with great careers, who he deeply admired. And yet in his fiction, he keeps up that fiction of every woman being the kind of angel in the home, as the Victorians wanted. So to me, it's quite fascinating how commercially driven he is.
It's good to talk to you about this rather than me try and sort of postulate on this, because I've read Dickens and thought some of the women are sort of dynamite, you know, really, really strong. And sort of, you know, people like, I don't know, Agnes and David Copperfield or Esther in Bleak House. But is it the case that Esther then is still, she's still quiet and sort of demure in some ways, that in a way that is acceptable to the sort of Victorian ideal?
So self-deprecating, it's quite hard to read in a modern way. She's always, I know they only said that to me because they were being kind. But actually, there's a lot of incredible women in Dickens, but they're the minority of his female characters. So the majority of them are seen to conform to the Victorian ideal of the perfect woman. That's not to say he didn't create well-rounded women. He did. Miss Wade is amazing. Miss Abby Potterson is amazing. Betsy Trotwood, I mean, one of the most brilliant women in literature. So I'm not saying he didn't create any great female characters. He really did. What frustrates me is that so many of them are kept by society. Perhaps that's what he's saying, in their place. And that is because that's what the public wanted. They wanted people to be in a certain way. They wanted the police at the beginning of Dickens's novels to be these figures of fun, these incompetents. Only when the detective department is set up in 1842 that this starts to change, that suddenly the police can actually start to be respected. So Dickens has to stick, as many people do, with the expected conceits of the time. Another great female character, she's not mentioned very often, but is Inspector Bucket's wife in Bleak House. She's a small character, but she, I think, is a prototype for Miss Marple. She's fantastic. She's going off sleuthing on her own. You know, he's a police inspector and she's going off and finding things out for him. He has some fantastic characters in there. But with the Battle of Life, which we mentioned earlier, which is the good and the bad woman, you know, the good and the bad sister, the virtuous, the believed to be non-virtuous, which actually we find out isn't true. They're both good women in inverted commas. These are the kind of the characterizations that people wanted at the time. And Dickens knew what the public wanted.
Yes, on the Battle of Life, actually, I read it and I loved it, actually. I found the ending a little bit mawkish, perhaps, but I really, just that opening description of the landscape and how battles had been fought there, and I felt like I was reading Chekhov at some points. I could really imagine, with the two sisters, I could really imagine those two sisters.
Absolutely wonderful. It's the plot I have a few problems with. But then I'm not a Victorian.
Yeah.
Dickens would watch things that we watch on TV, Netflix, whatever, and think that's just such rubbish. This was the Victorian mindset, and the Victorians loved this. And I mean, Dickens's writing is always excellent. I mean, his sentence structure, the way that he sets scenes, his description. Yeah, I mean, I would suggest that people read The Battle of Life, but I find the subject matter, the plot, can be quite difficult to take for modern minds. I wouldn't want people to read it as their first Dickens.
No, or the only Christmas book for this year for Dickens. Yeah, no, absolutely. No.
But of course, The Battle of Life is very apt for this year because it has the 175th anniversary of its publication this year. It was published in December 1846.
There we go. I think it's worth a read, isn't it? I think it's worth a read. I'll pick it up again. I was going to ask you, actually, this time of the rolling year is a very busy, active one for you in the Dickens realm. But as you come back to the stories over time, do they change for you? Do you have kind of rotational favourites, or are there parts of these stories that you know so well that surprise you?
I think that is always the case. The older you get, the things that you read change. And I think that I love it when I come back to something I haven't read for a few years, as long as I prefer it. It's awful when you read something you loved in your 20s and think, oh, that was terrible. But I do think with Dickens particularly, I love it when people tell me when they come to one of my talks or when I meet them at the Dickens Museum that they were really put off Dickens at school, but they've come back to him as an adult. I love it when people say, after your talk, I decided to read Dickens for the first time in 40 years, and I love it. That, to me, is the best thing anyone could say, because so many people were forced to read Dickens at school in a way that wasn't conducive to loving literature. I was very lucky. I didn't have that happen to me. I didn't read a huge amount of Dickens when I was at school, but I did at university, and I had the most amazing tutor. My Dickens tutor was a man called Tim Jordan, sadly no longer alive, who imbued in everybody his absolute love of Dickens. And I feel very grateful that I came to it properly at the age of 19, not at the age of 9. I read probably abridged versions as a child. Nobody forced me to read it. So many people were told, oh, you've got to read this. And they were always made to read Hard Times, which is one of the most difficult ones to read, one with the least amount of humour. And I think teachers choose it because it's short. But actually, they would be doing their students so many more favours if they got them to read something with a fabulous storyline like Our Mutual Friend.
Yes.
Or, Bleak House. Because they have great plots and subplots and all sorts of intrigue, fantastic characters. And Hard Times, which I have actually grown to like as an adult, didn't enjoy when I first read it in my early 20s. It's something I think you grow into. And I hope that people who haven't enjoyed Dickens will think after this podcast, well, maybe there is more to him. And actually, even you just now, you've inspired me to reread The Battle of Life. It's been a couple of years, and I love the fact that you're enthusiastic about it, Dom. So, yeah, I'm going to go back to it and look at it with a less cynical...
Oh, excellent. I'm very pleased to hear that, and I hope it lives up to the mantle I've placed it on. It's partly because I'd sort of heard that it wasn't meant to be very good, and so I came at it thinking, oh, well, I just want to read it and know it. And what's lovely about it are the seasons, the changes of the seasons, that landscape in the book, and because it's not all at Christmas time, is it? It jumps over quite a long time span, and so and you have the descriptions of the holly and the frost and everything, and all of that. It's really quite enchanting. I think I got the sense from reading your book again, actually, that Dickens sometimes got a bit sick of the winter weather and the need for it to always be very, very Christmassy, and so he sort of wanted to move away from that a little bit in some of these other books.
Also, Dickens was already starting to feel that Christmas was haunting him, no pun intended, as he would towards the end, particularly by the end of his life. I mean, he just got so frustrated by the fact that his whole year was being spent devoted to Christmas. And it was taking away the pleasure, which had been the very great pleasure for him, of Christmas. It was a time that he always loved. And then later in his career, he just became frustrated that he couldn't concentrate on anything else, that he was spending so much of his time writing Christmas stories. And that's why he, after 5 novellas, he stopped and started writing short stories instead, because he was devoting his whole time in The Battle of Life. And perhaps that's why it's, for me, a bit more difficult to read, is Dickens struggled writing it. He wrote to his friend saying, I have been through many battles of lives with trying to write this manuscript. He was living in Switzerland with his family. He took them to live in Switzerland that year. It was a couple of years after he'd gone out to Italy, and they spent 5 months in Switzerland, and he'd gone to Lausanne because it was beautiful. He had the mountains, he had the lake, but it would be a glorious place for his children to live. And he thought he'd be able to write. He'd have this peace and quiet and wonderful writing time. And then he realized that he couldn't write in peace and quiet, and that he was really missing London, which was a place he had a very love-hate relationship with. People think, oh, he's a London author. Dickens both loved and loathed London, and he was always desperate to escape it. But he actually described when he was in Switzerland and said, it draws me back. It's this magic lantern So he had to leave Switzerland. He went to Paris, and there he could finish writing The Battle of Life, because in Switzerland he had complete writer's block. And he actually said at one point, there is not going to be a Christmas book this year, because he just felt he couldn't get it written. So maybe that comes across, or maybe I was reading too much into it when I last.
No, I can imagine that, because you could easily pick the book up, couldn't you, and know that beforehand and think, oh yeah, well, that was a bit of a, you know, that was a bit of a laboured sentence. He's struggling here, isn't he? But actually you think, no, you have to remember who you're dealing with, don't you? But I think what's so interesting to come back then to A Christmas Carol is the fact that it's so swift, isn't it? And it's in 6 weeks that he writes it. And that, am I right that he was in a little bit of a difficult situation himself financially, or was a little bit teetering on the edge? And so there's that real need to get this story out and for it to work. And the message that he's sharing actually applies to himself. And I can imagine him being in a beautiful landscape in Switzerland and having nothing to stimulate him, like you said, and without that magic lantern, because he pedaled so fast through his life, didn't he?
Yes, with A Christmas Carol. In 1843, it was a very, very tough year for him. He was overdrawn at the bank. And that's, you know, today, I think, you know, most people have automatic overdrafts. You can go into them, you can go out of them. You don't get into trouble. That wasn't the case then. He was really frightened. And he had an expanding family. And it wasn't as easy to limit the number of children you had then. You know, contraception was just not that reliable. So when you were married and you had a family, there was always this fear. And it was a fear that you were going to have too many mouths to be able to afford to feed, just as his parents had had. He had this terror of his children ever ending up like he had, being, you know, the child of imprisoned debtors, and, you know, knowing that he was having to go out and work was something he didn't want his children to have to do. And so in some ways he wanted to protect them so much from all that, that they never knew about his own childhood, which perhaps was a mistake. Perhaps they could have understood him more if they'd known about the privations that he suffered from. But he didn't want them to know. He wanted them to have this glorious, happy, shielded childhood, which I think when they were adults, perhaps he regretted a little bit, because perhaps he saw them as too over-entitled, that they'd never struggled as he had struggled. But that was really where he was coming from when he was writing A Christmas Carol. And he just read the Blue Book, the report by his friend Dr. Thomas Southwood Smith, into the terrible conditions of how children, and adults as well, but children were labouring in mines, in factories, these awful conditions. How many children were living on the streets and starving on the streets? How many families couldn't feed themselves? So all of these things were crowding in, and he was very unhappy at that time. He was sunk in real depression, and that was really why he took his family to Italy the next year, because he was so low. And in Italy, he barely wrote anything apart from the chimes. It was highly unusual for him, except for copious letters, which he knew he would turn into a travelogue, his second travelogue, Pictures from Italy.
Yes.
He had to recuperate. He knew that his mental health was at such a precarious state that he needed to go away and be in sunshine in order to recover.
Yes, I think that's such an interesting point you make. I mean, because the idea that he's having depression and then he writes this most fantastic, uplifting Christmas book, that's a great gift to the world. I think there's something very Christmassy about that, about having to overcome those obstacles and rise above. And he does it not only for himself, but he does it for everybody that comes in contact with this little book. I think that's extraordinary.
And the fact that he had to partly self-publish it, his publishers would only pay some of the costs. They didn't think that it was a book that was going to do anything. So he had to foot the bill, particularly for the very expensive hand-tinted illustrations by his great friend John Leech, who, of course, Dickens wanted to pay very fair wages to. He wasn't going to, you know, not pay his friend enough for doing the illustrations. But the publishers didn't want that, so they wouldn't pay for those. So Dickens really was kind of paving the way for authors coming after him. You know, all those authors whose publishers don't believe in their dreams. Well, this is exactly what happened with Dickens in A Christmas Carol, and look how that turned out. And a cautionary tale to any publishers listening, Dickens actually changed his publishers after this, because Chapman and Hall hadn't had enough confidence in him and his idea. And he went to Bradbury and Evans, his second publisher. So, you know, there was a real campaigning zeal in so many aspects of his life when he was writing that book.
Yes. And what a book. What a book to end on. Oh, Lucinda, this has been fantastic.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and good luck with the podcast series.
Thank you so much. And everyone listening, Lucinda's book, Dickens and Christmas, which I'm holding up, but you can't see because this is all audio. Dickens and Christmas is an excellent read, gives you a fantastic overview into what Dickens was up to when he was writing those five books, which makes the reading of those five novels all the more interesting. And of course, I forgot to mention, Lucinda, actually, that the reason I picked up The Battle of Life is purely through reading this, because I was curious to know about the two sisters. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And just to say, Dickens and Christmas has just come out in paperback, so that's very exciting.
Excellent. Excellent. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Lucinda. That's been wonderful. And have a wonderful Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to everyone who's listening.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you for listening to Charles Dickens, A Brain on Fire. If you'd like to hear more episodes, be sure to subscribe to us, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.